So the reason why I invited the Crab Nebula to visit us and to participate in this conference is because I want to give a new proof, an additional new proof, for the difference between human beings and animals, the difference between man and beast. Because it should be clear that it's not enough to have heard that there's a difference between man and animal. It's not enough to just believe it or to remember that at some time you understood that there was a difference. But you have to keep proving it. It's not one of these things you can just prove once and then say, okay, now we know. You have to keep proving it. In fact, you have to live the proof. Each person in this room all the time has to be a living demonstration of the difference between man and animal. So now, how can the Crab Nebula help us in this? There's several different ways that are all connected with the same core, the same essential reason. Firstly, you see this image here. An animal, if man were an animal, we would not be seeing this, because the Crab Nebula is not visible to our eyes directly. You don't see it. You can look in the heavens all the time, you won't find the Crab Nebula. It's too small, too weak, too faint, whatever. And in fact, most of the objects of modern astrophysics are not directly visible to the human eye. We study them using scientific instruments. So we look at the scientific instruments, and they do something. And we say, aha, there's something out there. And also, we would not be talking about the Crab Nebula unless man, unless scientists were actively looking for something, searching for anomalies. It didn't come to us and hit us on the shoulder. It wasn't something you stumbled over on a pathway somewhere, taking a walk. But scientists actually actively were looking, something that also man, or only man, really does. Thirdly, these scientific instruments, which were necessary, without which we wouldn't be talking about the Crab Nebula, were constructed on the basis of certain physical principles. The telescopes and other types of instruments I'll show you some of form a kind of extension, a kind of development of our own sense organ. In a certain sense, they're an extension of our sense organs. But their construction was based on man's consciously mastering certain physical principles, certain universal physical principles, which are embodied concretely in the design of these instruments. Those are principles that no animal consciously mastered, that man accumulated over a long history of discoveries. But there's more. We're going to do, with these different observations, something also that no animal does. We're going to use them to develop paradoxes. We're not going to just do what most so-called scientists do, who are behaving often like animals, trying to just interpret their measurements instinctively or on the basis of what they learned, on the basis of textbook physics. We're not going to do that. We're going to be uniquely human. We're going to use these observations to deliberately generate paradoxes. On the basis of those paradoxes, we're going to use that to then locate and discover, through a process of reflection, using human reason, something flawed or incomplete, not in some detail of knowledge, but something flawed and incomplete about the whole way we think about the world. And by doing that, and then generate a new idea, a new conception, what's called an axiomatic conception, which actually changes, essentially, implicitly, everything about the way we think about the universe and the way we deal with the universe. And then, if we can prove the validity of this hypothesis, we prove that validity by demonstrating that we gain, by this new way of dealing with the universe, a growing power, a power over the universe which is demonstrated by also visible effects in economic development and so forth. So, another thing uniquely human, that in this process of discovery, the way this process of reflection called human reason involves a very different kind of relationship of us to other human beings, which is uniquely human, including uniquely human, a very intimate, very close, very profound relationship with people who are not alive anymore physically. Great scientists, great thinkers, great creative personalities with whom we carry out a dialogue, with whom we reflect upon our way of thinking with them in a platonic dialogue. And these creative personalities, they form a kind of a second celestial sphere. You know, the celestial sphere we talked about yesterday, you look up, you see all those stars. Well, there's another celestial sphere which is just in the mind. And on this sphere is populated by creative human personalities, which form, in a sense, our intellectual universe. Those stars of monads with whom we converse. To the result of increasing our powers to continue this process. So this is, I presented here very, in a condensed way, a kind of a multi-step, kind of ordered process, which at each step, from the sense perception to these scientific instruments, from the design principles of the scientific instruments, to paradoxes, ironically, which show that there's something flawed in those design, or incomplete in the design principles, to this dialogue with the great creative personalities, living and dead, to an increase in human power. So you have a succession there. So, let's go a little bit more in depth on this and these different phases of this, and start very, very simply the way it was done yesterday in different ways, with the realization that our senses do not tell us the truth, or at least they couldn't. It's not that they want to lie to us. They're not able to tell us what the real universe is. For example, you take some objects that are far away from us, look smaller. Are they really smaller? They look smaller. So by these very kinds of a simple paradox, we see that vision doesn't tell us the true size of objects. More importantly, we don't see the causes of things. We see things happening, we don't see their causes with our eyes or with other senses that we have to use our mind for. So let's see, next slide. We have a general problem. Once we realize there below is the notion of sense perception as it occurs in astronomy. We see the so-called sphere of the stars. And up there is the real universe. We've realized we don't see it directly. And the question is, how do we get from sense perception to the real universe? How do you do that? What kind of a process is that? And of course, it was mentioned also yesterday, Plato's discussion of this essential problem of knowledge or epistemology, particularly in the allegory of the cave and in all of his dialogues, how he discusses this notion of the shadows, sense perception as the shadow. And this arises very clearly in astronomy, as we show. So, now, there's a whole study of this problem, which the classical Greeks carried out through geometry. And many people don't understand that. Many people think, oh yeah, Greek geometry, it's about straight lines and circles and points and figures, triangles, and so on. That's not quite true. That's not adequate. The geometry of the Platonic tradition, from Pythagoras, from Thales, taken from Egypt, as embodying the breakthroughs in Egypt and so forth, This geometry, what Lin calls the pre-Euclidean geometry, the geometry before the Aristotelian, before Aristotle essentially took over the teaching of geometry. This geometry is actually ontological. What it's really about is this problem. And I'll demonstrate that to you in a moment. One of the topics of investigation of this classical geometry was the construction of what were called means, mitte, moyen, geometrical mean, arithmetic mean, harmonic mean. You've heard these different expressions, which have to do with, it would appear at first with numbers and length of lines. For example, you have two numbers, 2 and 8. How can you get from 2 to 8 by some kind of a mean, some kind of a number which is a step between 2 and 8? Well, one way to do it, the so-called geometrical mean, is by 4. To get from 2 to 4 is by doubling, and to get from 4 to 8 is by doubling again. So you have the same relationship. And 4 mediates, so to speak, the transition from 2 to 8. Well, this question, and of course it's interesting, that at least in the languages I know, the concept of mean, which sometimes means something in the middle, also, in all the languages I'm familiar with, also signifies something with which you do something, an instrument, a power, implicitly. As we say, a mittel. A mittel can be something in the middle, but also something with which you do something in German. Moyen, same thing. In Russian, средство. Сред means in the middle. Средство is something with which you do something. And so forth. So, let's illustrate this problem of the means through a geometrical problem that you're all familiar with, which I'll mention very briefly. First slide. Overhead. I'll just say it very briefly because you'll remember it from our discussion. Warm up here. Just eine Klappe aufmachen. Ja, gut. Okay. So, here you have the familiar problem. Let me get my laser here. Oops. The way it's working. Okay. The problem of doubling a square. Here's a square, and you want to construct a square with double the area. And the Greek geometers understood and derived that problem, geometrically, can be solved if you can find between a length 1 and a length 2 an intermediate length called the geometrical mean, a length for which the ratio 1 to A equals A to 2. And you can see this also in the solution, or the common solution. Here we took our square. We doubled the side here. That gave us 4. Then we made the diagonal here. And the diagonal actually has this characteristic. First, we notice, in fact, it's true, the red square will have double the area as the original square. At the same time, if you look at it, this was mentioned also yesterday, the ratio between the side here, 1, if we assume the original square is side 1, 1 to A, the original side to A, and now look at the relationship between A and look at this larger triangle. Another way you can understand the geometrical mean is how do you go from the original square to the larger square? Imagine you found the right value for A. You take your square and you stretch it in the horizontal direction to get a rectangle. And then you stretch stretch it again in the vertical direction to get the square. So the rectangle is a mean in area between the original square and the second square. Next slide. Now the problem is to double a cube. Here, hypothetically, I have a cube of side 1 on the left up there, and a cube, which now I'm assuming hypothetically I've been able to construct, a volume 2, twice the volume, and with some side A. Now, how do I get from the one cube to the other cube? Well, I have to find this length A. Well, I can imagine it's done in the following way. I start with the original cube, and I extend it in one direction, pulling it, so to speak, out lengthwise, so it has one side equal to A. That will increase the volume by the same proportion. Secondly, I now pull it up by the same amount A, I get the second one. And finally, I stretch it in depth by the same proportion to get the cube. Now by that I have two steps from first cube to the whatever you call it, box, then the second box, and then finally to the cube. And each step involves the same proportionality of change of volume. So in fact, the problem of doubling the cube is equivalent, if we can represent volumes by straight lines, to constructing two means between 1 and 2. The volume of the second box there for A squared. And you have, again, the same proportionality of change of volume between these steps. Okay, now how do you do that? Let's turn off this thing. This sounds all very simple. And if you think about space in terms of just stretching things like rubber, then you say, what's the big deal? Space is just what you call linear extension. But it's not. Let's look at the next one. Oh yeah, before I get to that. Just to notice what I was saying about the idea of a mean, that this idea is not just geometry. There's a famous painting of Leonardo, which shows Leonardo's understanding of the ontological significance of this discussion, where you see the angel here with making a mean between this relationship, which one can think of as also signifying a relationship between sense perception and the real universe. The notion of the mean as characteristic for the human mind. Next one. Okay, so here you have the very banal conception of extension in space. Can I stick it? The idea of things just sort of growing continuously. Next. Here's a problem with the square. You can skip over this one. You can go further. Oh, there it goes. Now the doubling of the cube I already explained, and the problem of finding two means between two extremes, find the A and the B. Now, it was mentioned yesterday that actually doubling a square, even doubling a line, to actually get double the length, requires actually doing something which is not part of just the world of straight lines. You have to have a rotation double the length of a line. Double a square, we have to get the idea of a diagonal. Now, we went into a different realm, which also involves rotation. Now, what about, but in both those two cases, the solution could be constructed, or at least seems to be constructible, on the basis of ordinary procedures of geometry, what you learn in geometrical construction, a ruler and compass. Although actually the idea, as Plato showed in the main one, the idea of doubling the square is not part of the procedures of geometry. Now in the case of doubling the cube, it turns out there's no solution in the ordinary procedures of construction, geometrical construction, according to Euclid. You cannot double a cube using Euclidean procedures. That was established and known to the Platonics, known to Archytas. It's a very crucial point. The problem belongs to a kind of higher power. You have to go outside the bounds of formal geometry and its procedures and to generate a completely different kind of idea. And this idea, a kind of notion which is not directly geometrical, it's a kind of notion in the mind of an idea, a general notion of creation or generation. Let's see the next one. This is the result of that notion, was the famous construction by Archytas, a friend of Plato, for how to construct these two means, A and B, starting with the original length. I won't go into this. I think there's a beautiful model of Andreas, which I hope she brought, or she can show the people here. Others should make them. A model of this construction. But it involves the intersection of three surfaces. A cylinder, a torus, and a cone. And these two means between the two extremes are generated as a result of the combination of these three types of action. These surfaces are not just static things, but they're thought of as reflecting different modes of action. This is no longer Euclidean geometry. This is not just drawing triangles and measuring angles. You're in a different world. So now, we wanted to double the cube. Those are two figures in ordinary Euclidean geometry. But to do that, we had to go outside Euclidean geometry. We had to go through something which is non-visual, a kind of thinking which is non-visual. So what does that mean? It means that this idea of simple extension in space, simple Euclidean space, is not a true one. It's not the real universe. And there's no simple action in the real universe. As a result of this, and what this example, what this case was designed by Archytas and the others as a proof of, that there is no simple way to go from sense perception to knowledge about the real universe. There's no formula, there's no procedure, there's no software that you can apply some kind of Euler Lagrange formula, where you can plug in sense perception and it comes out, okay, this is the way, this is the real thing. It doesn't work that way. You have to go outside the domain of formal procedures. And one crucial element of that is you have to look at sense perception, the sensorium so-called, as something created, not as something which is just there. But behind this sensorium is a process of creation. Now, okay, so there are three conclusions out of the work of Archytas and related work of that time. Again, conclusions which are not part of ordinary geometry. They're what this whole work on geometry is really about. Firstly, they deal with the question of the nature of the universe and the relationship between sense perception and the universe. First, as I said, there's no simple, deductive, or formal relationship between sense perception and the real universe. There is a lawful relationship, but not formal. Secondly, the relation, to understand it, you have to conceptualize better and better a process of continuous creation or generation. And thirdly, the hypothesis that the relationship between sense perception and the true universe involves somehow two means, two additional species, intermediate, so to speak, between sense perception and the principle of creation of the universe itself. Not in the sense of things, but phases of the process. Let's go forward. Okay. Now, it was exactly this classical Platonic conception to which Nicholas of Cusa returns in the middle of the 15th century, with particularly his Docta Ignorantia and a book written around the same time to which Nicholas of Cusa refers to in the Docta Ignorantia called De Conjecturis, on conjecture or on hypothesis. And there, in a very explicit form, as in other writings, Nicholas Cruz develops this notion of what he calls the four unities. Here's the next one. The four unities, sense perception, and then two unities between, so to speak, sense perception and the universal principle of creation. One he called the faculty of understanding, and the other the faculty he called reason, or the Vernunft, or the creative Vernunft. Just to go in the opposite direction, we have first the universe considered as not a lot of objects, but simply as a single principle, a single idea, in the same way we were talking about music. That the universe, just as a great work of music is the expression of a single idea, so the visible universe and everything else is the expression of a single idea, a single principle, grand principle of creation. That principle of creation is the real universe. Then we have human reason, which is enfolded or created out of that great principle of creation, of which we are a kind of expression, and we participate in that, which itself imitates creation by creating a discovering, a growing array of principles, of universal physical principles and new conceptions. Then we have understanding, this second mean, so to speak, a lower mean, actually. Is it something that involves the elaboration of discoveries or principles that one has discovered? They are elaborated into a body of knowledge and practice. For example, in the design of technology, the design of scientific instruments, which are based on principles that we discovered through reason. And the understanding is that by which we, in practice, most of the time, interpret sense perception. It is an ironic relationship between these four unities. For example, sense perception by itself cannot identify what is happening to it. Right? The eyes say flash, 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 flash. The eyes by themselves don't see anything, don't identify anything. That requires a higher potentiality of the mind. Our touch perception says, hurt, 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 feel good, hurt, heart, heart. Harm, soft. Don't identify objects. So, it's the understanding, the elaborated, evolving array of knowledge by which we interpret sense perception, including the scientist who sees his instruments going, whoop, 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 and says, okay, this is the Crab Nebula. Right? Does that on the basis of certain elaborated knowledge. But that's understanding. So understanding, Verstand, or rationality, you might use this word, can elaborate principles, it can combine and compare, it can reason in a rational way, but it can never go outside the limits of the basic concepts and assumptions that it has learned from reason, hopefully from reason and not from the devil. Only reason, only the principle of reason, or that faculty of reason, can actually go beyond any level of elaborated knowledge. By the method of Platonic hypotheses, by discovering paradoxes, actually looking for paradoxes, hunting them down, forcing them out, to generate a new conception which changes the way we think of the universe. But also, human reason is not the universe itself. Beyond that is a universal principle of creation, which is the source of human powers. So human reason is not everything. If that means also the process of discovery is unending. The joy of discovery never ends. So we're in the best of all possible worlds. So by this, Nicholas of Cusa here in this diagram, and things like he describes it, actually defines for the first time modern experimental method as a kind of a flow, a double relationship among these four unities, which in another way of thinking about it, which Leibniz had, is actually the definition or a certain way of defining what a true nation state is as a process. Next. So this is what now is filled in two unities here. In the case of astronomy, we have the sense perception. We have the domain of technology, of scientific instruments, and the way we interpret them based on principles already discovered. And then we have a process of hypothesizing, using the faculties of reason, which is something which most people are terrified about. Don't know quite what that is. And then you have the universe beyond that. This is exactly what Kepler actually made the great breakthrough in actually demonstrating the principle of Kusa in full force, in action, in actu, in the new astronomy particularly. Let's see the next one. Okay. This was already gone through yesterday, just to say it with a moment. In a moment, here we have part of the sky. If we use our understanding, we construct instruments to point and to measure and to record the measurements, then we find this peculiar motion of Mars in reference to the stars. First it seems to move like something normally, then it suddenly seems to stop. This other thing is the moon. It's set up. Here are the days, the date. This was from 1995. This process, you see the days going by. The moon's running across. Okay. See the next one? So, here Kepler says, okay, look, we have this sensorium, the celestial sphere, which has a very specific geometry. These instruments we built were based on the conception of angular displacement. Angles are what we measure. What Tycho Brahe was measuring, basically just angles. And we observed first in the motion, stars coming up and going down in circular motion. The sun is a little more complicated. There are two motions, a yearly cycle and a daily cycle. But all seems to be derivable from just circular rotation, different combinations. But now you have Mars and a paradox of this paradoxical motion. And Kepler was able to demonstrate that this motion is incompatible, cannot be constructed by any combination of the then known principles of physics, particularly not through rotational processes, not by some combination of rotation. You can approximately, but not exactly. The real motion cannot be predicted by a simple mathematical computation based on the notion of mechanical action, gears, your idea of a machine. It's a different kind of process. And out of this, Kepler conceived, in a sense, guiding the planet along its way, there's something else which is not visible. It's not a machine behind. It's not really a machine producing this projection. But it's a principle which is guiding the planet along a trajectory which is involves change, changing curvature, and is expressed by the elliptical orbit. But not only by the elliptical orbit, there's also the solar system exists as a kind of organism in which everything happening in part of it is connected with everything happening in every other part. A harmonically organized, like a great orchestra, like a living process. That conception that Kepler developed in his new astronomy is the conception of universal gravitation. It's not a force. That's not the idea. It's a principle of composition of the solar system. So, and I think this was very important that Kepler did this, not just for science, because I think through this breakthrough of Kepler, his new astronomy particularly, European civilization and mankind, if you think of the civilization going through this disaster during his lifetime, of the 30 Years' War, and the wars that went before that, Kepler contributed, I think, a key to rebuilding European civilization after that Holocaust. Namely, a sense of confidence in the creative powers of the human mind, to lift civilization again out of barbarism. Now, this new principle of Kepler's could not be expressed using the mathematics. The mathematics at that time was inadequate, didn't work. Therefore, a new type of mathematics had to be created, particularly through Fermat, through the work of Bernoulli, through Leibniz, was created something which is sometimes referred to as the infinitesimal calculus. So new mathematics had to be created also. So let's go further. Now we come to the present and back to the crab, nebula. Now in the meantime, through the scientific revolution which Kepler unleashed and which continued and built up more and more through Leibniz, through Huygens, through Fermat, to Leibniz, and so on. We had one technological revolution after the other. And now those instruments, which produced these strange images I'm about to show you, are based on design principles that were discovered, which were based on what Kepler discovered and what was discovered after that. For example, also based on industrial society. Modern, scientifically driven industrial society. That which was established in the United States, in Germany, and other nations, which is collapsing around us now. But fortunately, there's still some remainder of that which has been continuing, optimistically, its development around space, around astrophysics, and produced these instruments like, for example, the X-ray telescope Chandra, which uses some very remarkable new type of optics. These are not optics in the visual light, but X-ray. It actually detects X-rays and makes images in X-rays. This Chandra telescope had to be put into orbit in an elliptical orbit to take it away from the radiation belt of the Earth, which is very noisy. It's also noisy because it's being hit by the sun all the time. And here you see the production of this satellite. Next. Here you have another type of astronomy called interferometry. This is not just looking at a single instrument. You build a whole array of instruments. In this case, these are radio telescopes. Here, an array of radio telescopes. And then the signals from those telescopes are compared with each other. There's slight differences. And the relationship between those signals represents something. Which the astronomer says, okay, now I'm looking at the craft. Not with the eyes. Also not directly with the instruments, but as a kind of interpretation of what the instruments show. Another thing is here, very relevant to the crab, a new type of astronomy that didn't exist 50 years ago, certainly not in this form, is called gamma ray astronomy. It's an astronomy based on the detection of extremely high energy so-called cosmic rays, or otherwise described as it's light that has a wavelength about 1 trillion times shorter than visible light. Tera electron volt is called. Trillion electron volt gamma rays. They come into the atmosphere from somewhere. They create a whole kind of a flash of generation of different types of radiation. And then this is observed. And finally, at the end of this whole process, light is produced and the light flashes are detected. So that's just as a couple of examples. What we're talking about now with astronomy is not just looking up with your eyes at the heavens, but you have this whole array of instruments. Next. And here just show a section of the so-called electromagnetic spectrum, where you have here the radio waves, which I mentioned. Actually, very, very thin, it's just about one octave spectrum of visible light, and then the X-rays and gamma rays beyond that. Next. Okay, so now we come to the crab, and let's see what kind of an entity we're talking about. Well, here we see one image of this. It's actually taken with two different instruments, an X-ray telescope in orbit, and I think a ground-based telescope, but a very good one, which shows the essential one image of the crab. The crab was first noticed or first observed in the 18th century, I think at 1731, a period when the telescopes were being developed very rapidly. And it was seen just as a kind of a little cloud, a nebula, as it was called, in the sky. Later, particularly in the 19th century, as the telescopes improved, including through the work of Gauss, who worked very closely with the machine tool industries, including around Bavaria, Fraunhofer, and so forth, to improve telescopes. This cloud then began to differentiate itself and had these funny kind of arms, which you can see here, these filaments or whatever, which caused it to be given this name of the crab. These funny filaments here. Next. Alright. Now we come to the present situation. And here we have four pictures taken with four different types of instruments operating in four different wavelength ranges of electromagnetic radiation. But they're all pointed at the same place in space. Remember what Lynn was saying yesterday. We have our X-ray telescope that shows us this. We have an optical telescope with visible light that shows us this. We have an infrared device, telescope detecting infrared, or sometimes called heat radiation, here. And then, it's so easy to see, we have the radio telescope, gives us also a different image. Now this should actually shake us up a little bit. Because if the different instruments are giving us different images, presumably of the same object, but which is the object? What are we actually looking at? Obviously, we're not looking at some simple object out there. We're looking at something which is generating, doing things to our instruments. So the instruments are giving us different types of images. But there is a kind of coherence. Let's see the next. Here, for example, this is the shoulder. In the first case, the telescope was used with a filter for blue light, the upper picture, and below a filter emitting red light, you see they're very different pictures. These filaments are gone in blue light, they appear in red light. There's some kind of organization there. Some parts of this process are generating in red, others in blue, and so on. Next. Here's a modern picture with the orbiting Hubble telescope of these filaments. Very extraordinary. In anticipating a little bit, I should tell you that the textbook interpretation of the Crab Nebula is that it is the debris, the remnants, the leftover from a huge explosion. It's what, you know, imagine you have a huge explosion. It happened, according to certain evidence, around the year 1054. It was recorded by Chinese astronomers, a very bright object in the sky. And for various reasons I might mention, what we see now is considered to be something that developed out of that explosion. But the common textbook idea is there was a big explosion, something well organized exists before then, and then boom. You don't expect after an explosion very much except, you know, interesting. However, this looks a little bit more organized than just something after a bomb goes off. Next. Here you have pictures taken with a so-called polarizing filter, which registers the characteristics, the angular characteristics of light. Light has also a kind of orientation in space. And depending on the orientation, you again also see different images. In particular, it's very weak in one orientation and very strong in another, which indicates all the light coming from this object has a very dominant orientation, or called polarization. The whole object, which maybe is very large. I haven't now gone into how could we find out how big this thing is. Is it close to us? Is it far away? What is it? We'll get to that next. All right. And here, we're looking more closely at what the X-ray telescope Chandra, starting around 1999, has been making images of this area. And here you see something very, very different in the pictures, the other optical pictures, which coheres with certain other things that have been observed. This is in X-rays. In fact, most of the radiation coming from this something is not in visible light, but it's in X-rays. Very high energy, very powerful radiation. Moreover, some of it, not as much, but still a lot, is coming to us in the domain of high energy gamma rays, as I mentioned before. Gamma rays, a trillion times shorter wavelength than visible light, and between 1,000 and 1,000,000 times higher intensity than the radiation produced by any known nuclear processes, like nuclear fission, nuclear bombs. They produce some gamma rays. Those gamma rays are 1,000 times less intense, or maybe about between 1,000,000 and 1,000 times less intense, longer wavelength than the gamma rays produced by, or some of the gamma rays, which we observe from this strange animal out there. Also in the middle of this is the is here something from which in different wavelengths other instruments detect pulses of radiation, something called a pulsar. And a very presumably small object which is producing 30 times a second pulses of radiation across essentially the whole electromagnetic spectrum. Very precisely 30 times a second. Now, this area here, according to our best estimate, let's say if we apply known principles, which I'll mention in a moment, to get an idea about the size or scale, interpreting this object as if it would be an object just in three-dimensional space, we arrive at the conclusion that it's extremely large, it's an immense object, that this inner ring from here to here, this ring here, the inner ring, has a diameter of approximately one light year. So light would take light traveling at 300,000 kilometers per second would take about a year to go from one end of this inner circle to the other end. So it's about 10 to the 13th kilometers. So it's 10 million kilometers. If we use these kinds of ideas of scale, which we have to ask ourselves, are they valid? But if we use them, that's what we come up with. So it's a very large object. Let's now see the Chandra actually made a series of observations about every 21 days, made seven of them, which were put together to make a kind of a movie, which I'll show you now. Anyway, the pulsing you're seeing is not the pulse of the pulsar. It's just because it's repeated the seven pictures. Now bear in mind, as I said, you've just seen seven pictures, one after the other, and then it's looped. You recall that you saw changes, very big changes, from one picture to the other. Since waves seem to be created, the object is changing. But it's also very, very large. This is not like our very quiet, very tranquil solar system. There's a lot happening on the Earth, but over very long periods, it seems to just develop very smoothly. This is vastly larger, and it's changing very quickly. Let's see now a second film, which was taken using the Hubble telescope at the same moments of time as the Chandra. And here, something very striking, very paradoxical, actually. This is an enormous object. It's changing. If you compare the pictures, you see that the changes are occurring everywhere in the object. Every part of the object is changing at the same time. And yet the object is so large that it would take light about 10 light years to go from one end to the other. Think about that. So next one. Okay, now another characteristic of the Crab Nebula. This is a negative picture with light and dark reversed. This first picture was taken in 1973. Now let's see the next one. That was taken in 2000. Go back and forth between the two. If you look carefully at the stars, relative to the stars, you'll see that the crab is actually growing. This was indicated already in the 1920s, and these pictures also indicate something paradoxical. It seems that it's growing faster with time. The growth is accelerating. Okay. Next. Now, this is not an ordinary picture. This is the so-called spectrum of the Crab Nebula. It's the light coming from, visible light coming from the Crab Nebula, put through something called a diffraction grating, which splits the light into different frequencies. And also the frequencies or wavelengths are measured across the length of the crab. So, as people know from chemistry laboratory, there's something called spectroscopy, that every chemical element, when it's heated up or energized, emits light in very specific frequencies. They appear as lines in a so-called spectrum. Remarkable here in the case of the crab is, instead of getting a simple line, if you look on the left, you have actually two lines. And they seem to come together at the ends. This corresponds to the ends of the Crab Nebula. And one line is a little bit lower in frequency than the same element would have on the Earth, and the other line is a little bit higher in frequency. Let's see the next one. Here you have nitrogen lines. I think the nitrogen line. I'm not sure exactly. Anyway, there you have actually two sets of three lines. One shifted, so to speak, in the red that shifts to lower wavelengths, and one shifted to higher wavelengths. This is an anomalous thing. You don't see this really in the laboratory. What is this? Next. Okay. Now, if we take on the level of the understanding, what I call this unity called the understanding, we take known principles. We take some of these measurements, and we start to look at them from the standpoint of known principles. So we say, okay, well, it's expanding. We have this shift of the wavelengths. Well, that we can understand. We seem to understand on the basis of these principles of propagation of light. If something is moving toward you very fast and it emits light at a certain frequency, when the light comes to you, it will be slightly shorter in wavelengths, called a blue shift. If something is moving away from you very quickly, the light will be shifted, when it gets to you, shifted down in frequency with longer wavelength. That's called a red shift. And you saw these the spectral lines, one was shifted to the red, one to the blue. Well, that makes sense. If the thing is expanding in all directions, and you're looking at it, part of it is coming toward you, and part of it is going away from you. So part will be shifted to the blue, and part to the red. So if you apply known principles, you come to an estimate of the speed of motion, which is about, the estimate is about 1,400 kilometers per second. The speed that the shell of the crab, I call it also the cocoon, this outer fabric, is expanding. Using that, it's some geometry, simple geometry, again, from understanding, I won't go through it, one can estimate now also how large the object is. Because it's expanding at a certain rate, we can see the angle, so-called angular expansion, about 1/10 of a second of arc every year. That's about 1/30,000. 1/36,000 of a degree. It's a very small angle. That's how much it expands per year. If the velocity is 1,400 kilometers per second, we get an idea how far is that at the crab. Then we can calculate how big is the crab as a whole, and we come up with this estimate that the crab is about 10 light years in diameter. I'm not saying this is true. This is what our understanding tells us based on known principles. We're assuming things. We're assuming light propagates the same way. We're assuming there might not be a change, something we're overlooking, but that's the conclusion we come to. So next. All right. still now, from the standpoint of understanding, there's a whole array of paradoxes. I only mentioned them, some briefly. One is, well, firstly, none of the astronomers whose practice is to interpret observations based on known theory, none of them predicted anything like what we've been observing in recent years. What the instruments are doing and showing us, or at least responding to, does not correspond to what was predicted. Nuclear fission by a factor of 1,000 or 1,000,000. And third, most provocative, we have a very large, apparently, what our understanding says must be a very large object, about 10 light years across, its inner part 1 light year across. It's changing in a coherent way. It's producing coherent pulses of radiation of different sorts. So, but at the same time, the parts of it are so far apart. How do they know, how does each part know what the other part is doing? How is it organized, if it's so large? So, it seems that there's a correlation that doesn't have really anything to do with the propagation of effects from one place to another. Now, we have something that's called the speed of light, which I mentioned. That's supposed to be some kind of a limit, right? If that were a limit, then the larger an object is, the slower it should change, because it takes so much time for effects to propagate. But we look at the crab and it's just changing, boop, 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 boop. The whole thing is changing. It doesn't seem to notice that there's a limit of the speed of light. It doesn't pay any attention to that. It says, I don't care. That's in the textbook. Huh? So now, next one. Now to end, I want to, let's go now, enter into this domain of reason, or make an attempt. This domain of reason, let's think about what this means. Well, now this is actually, this domain of reason is something very special, and as I mentioned, it's also very terrifying for some people, many people. As Rembrandt is painting this painting, to give a certain sense of part of it, a characteristic of the domain of reason is it's a process going on entirely within what Lim calls the sovereign processes of a single individual human mind, in your soul, in an individual soul. Entirely in the individual soul. Secondly, reason by its characteristic tries to focus on the essentials. It doesn't want to be distracted. It doesn't introduce arbitrary things. What does it do? It does what Helga was mentioning yesterday, going into yesterday in Herbart. It's actually changing the relationships of the Geistesmassen in our soul. Changing those relationships. It doesn't mean discovering a fact, getting some idea, but it means actually, in the usual sense, but it means you're actually, your entire mind is changed by this process. That's the characteristic of reason. In reason, the mind operates as a unity. That you are changing the substance of your mind. And this is the realm of true freedom. This is what you can read in the Corinthians that Lynn often cites. But you're face to face with the question of truth. None no longer understanding it. Intense concentration. This is very important. So in the youth movement, we have a wonderful social process of discussion, of deliberation, and so forth.
which is great, and thinking.
There's one element which is there, which is developing, but must develop much more. This question of the individual concentration. Folks, the working in the group, the discussion, the excitement, that creates the conditions for this process to go on in each individual mind. And then we get to the point where it is concentrating also more on what is this process. Came up again and again yesterday. So we're not, in this mode, we're not trying to explain the Crab Nebula. Forget about that. We're not making theories about the Crab Nebula. This is crap. The crap. This is not what happens in reason. In reason, the main reason, we don't make theories. In fact, if you can explain something on the basis of a theory, you can be sure it doesn't exist in the real universe. The evidence that there is something that exists is the anomalous nature of the Crab Nebula. It's the anomalies that tell us about something that exists. The things we can explain are the side that's in a sense not existent, or not primary existence. It's like when you talk about Lin. Lin is a walking anomaly. Right? He is an anomaly. He is a continuous anomaly. And that anomaly is his existence. That's what Leibniz called substance. Furthermore, what we're looking for here in this domain is not, it's a universal principle. And a very important struggle with this notion is the notion of what does it mean a universal principle? It's not about the crab. It's not about something else. It's a universal principle. The consideration of that may help us. It may be useful like a motif in a composition. But motif is not the idea of the composition. It's something the composer chooses to communicate an idea. But we can choose the crab as a motif for the purpose of doing something else. So we're not sitting and thinking about the crab. But we're thinking about the way we think about it. Characteristic of reason. Characteristic of reason is the object of reason is the way we're thinking about something. So we get to a first stage of this is very negative. It appears to be very negative. What Kruse called the negative theology. We first say, look, present day physics is crap. It doesn't work. There may be useful things that we can say about it, obviously. Our technology is based on it. These wonderful instruments were based on certain real discoveries. But basically, our present-day physics is defective. In two ways. Firstly, it's incomplete, as any knowledge is. Secondly, also, it has been crapped up. It's been pumped full of nonsense. It has been corrupted. And Lin emphasized this, that actually science has been killed. This level of science that I'm talking about, the actual hypothesis formation, the process of hypothesizing, has essentially stopped. Almost nobody is doing this. Just look at any research paper in astronomy, you'll see it, or astrophysics. What are they doing? They're interpreting evidence on the basis of schemes of physical laws, known laws, standard accepted theory, accepted procedures. No. They have alternative theories. One says it's this. One says it's this. They fight. But all the theories are based on the same fundamental assumptions. No. There's no actual hypothesizing going on, but just construction of elaboration of existing knowledge. On top of this, we have the way that science was destroyed through empiricism, through the empiricism of Aristotle and upgraded turbo form under Sarpi and Descartes and leads to Newton and so forth. And the evidence of this kind of corruption is you can find all over astrophysics, including the discussion about the crab, is the domination of the notion of entropy. The idea of the universe is running down. Well, it's basically it had something going on, you know, it was churned up, it was moving, and it's sort of slowly running down. This was the idea of Kant, Laplace, Clausius, Lord Kelvin, expressed as the so-called heat death of the universe, expressed in different ways also in what I mentioned. The idea, oh yes, you had sometime you had some kind of a star there, and then it had a great explosion called a supernova explosion, and now what you're looking at is what's left over. Same entropic idea. Left over, you're just seeing the shards that, and so forth. The universe is running down. Now let's use reason. Let's examine this way of thinking. Let's ask ourselves, what is the actual source of these kinds of conclusions, of this kind of idea? Did it come from observation? Did it come from some kind of perception? Some kind of real evidence? If we do that, we critically examine where certain ideas came from in science, certain ways of thinking. We find out it did not come from a process of discovery. It did not come, the idea of entropy, universal entropy that is, did not come from any observation, from any scientific discovery. It was the manipulation of science. Quite the opposite. If we see this crab, and we have different pictures, we don't know, none of the pictures are the real thing. But for sure, we have here a process, it's some kind of gigantic, the equivalent of a gigantic dimension. But it's not behaving like a slow dinosaur or something. It's behaving like a very peppy, busy process, busy doing something. All kinds of things. That's why it's so anomalous. It's active. Very large process, very rapidly changing. It seems that it's producing something, it's going somewhere. It's evolving towards some kind of result. Compared to the solar system, Kepler had this original notion of the solar system implicitly as an evolutionary process. The solar system right now, our sun, is a wonderfully peaceful star. All over, as you begin to look, you think that the heavens are peaceful. No, no. The more closely you look, the more violent, the more wild the stars are. These variable stars, they increase their light output by 1,000 times for a few hours. Then they go back again. Some pulse regularly. Some do it once in a while. If our sun did that, we'd be gone. Our sun is very happy because it has its solar system. No. It has its children going around it. Right? So it can have a peaceful old age in happiness. So the crab is changing very rapidly. And as I mentioned, obviously, this is as a motif very crucial. It's obviously not organized by signals or some kind of effects going from one place to another. That may be happening as an effect. But this very rapid change suggests the idea of a change of curvature, that we have a process underlying all this, a special kind of process. It's like the change of a mind, in a certain way. We're watching a process beyond these different images. The thing is like what Kepler was talking about as the principle of universal gravitation. You have something behind them. You have a trajectory of change, which is a trajectory of evolution. It's a trajectory of development. And that development has the characteristic of it changes in the geometry of the whole process. So that what is determining the correlation of events is not propagation, is not chains of cause and effect that we study in physics, but is changes in the whole geometry of the process. And it's very intense. And the fact that because the concept of the whole geometry is changing its curvature, makes sense in terms of this high energy radiation. What is high energy radiation? What does it really mean? That's an axiomatic character, the change in geometry. This radiation, which is beyond the periodic table, something more fundamental than the periodic table. What's going on there is not some kind of combination of elements. Something more like a generation of periodic tables. So, ordinary mathematical physics, we get to a constant trajectory as an ordered process of change of geometry, which ordinary mathematical physics can't handle. It doesn't have anything that works for that. But we do have a seed crystal of a mode of understanding this. One is, of course, physical economy, Lim's approach to physical economy, the primary one. It gives us a kind of a notion of what kind of thing we're talking about. And mathematically, the work of Riemann, as understood from Lim's standpoint, as understood Riemann's geometry, as understood from the standpoint of what Held was saying about Herbart, and particularly what Lim was, has been elaborating. Particularly these things called elliptic and abelian functions, which came developed out of the impulse of Kepler's work as a notion of changing geometry of a whole process. A process not as an assembly of elements, but a process of changing geometry. So, we can look at these things, elliptic and abelian functions, at the work of Riemann and his successor Abel. That's where it comes, Abelian functions in the Norwegian. Not from the standpoint of some kind of nice mathematics, but from the standpoint of Archytas and Plato. What does it mean ontologically? What does it mean epistemologically? And so we get out of this, we have to get out of this, unleash a process of developing a new astronomy, of doing what Kepler did single-handedly, in his new astronomy, in his life's work. And this will be, I think, I can be sure, very beneficial for mankind. Because in the coming period, we're going to have to put the world economy also through a succession of geometrical changes. We're not just building things here and there. When you talk about a global infrastructure system, you're talking about something which is planetary, in the sense that Vernadsky used the word planetary. You can't just look at the isolated part. You have to look at how the whole planet is organized. Its weather, its climate, its water system, its resources. So, it's not making silly computer models. Exactly the so-called climate models show us the nonsense, which the Crab Nebula should teach us is nonsense, which Vernadsky showed us is nonsense. The biosphere of Vernadsky, the evolution of the biosphere, is not a process of interaction inside the biosphere. It's a process of change of the entire biosphere as a whole. So, also we begin to look at with the Crab Nebula, maybe it's something a little bit like what Lynn talked about, the star which is generating a solar system, which is generating elements around it, generating planets, or maybe it's something a little different. Certainly it's something in that direction. By that we may get a knowledge of what is our own astrophysical history. What is the nature of the elements on the Earth? What is the nature of the living process? These objects, astrophysical objects, again, objects I mean in the sense of these anomalies. These packages of anomalies. And it seems that the more you look at the heavens, the more densely populated it is with anomalies. Literally, we seem to be looking at a universe which is not just standing there, not evolving just on huge, long time scales, like millions or billions of years. But it's actually, things are going on very quickly also. So, we get a sense that we have to, what Lim talked about in his 3x3 matrix. You look at a Vernadskian universe which has these three three species of principles, of groups of principles, the ones associated with non-living processes, living processes, and those associated with the action of reason. But there's also, if you think of those as, let's say, rows in a matrix, there are also some columns. Namely, we can look at these processes experimentally on the microphysical scale, going down to the atomic, the subatomic. We can look at them on the scale of our ordinary sense perception. And we can look at it on the astrophysical scale, with these seemingly very large objects. Objects which have certain characteristics that suggest the concept of some kind of reflection of the principle of life. Something like this. Very fascinating. So we're essentially also looking at in these columns, we also have a column or an entry in this table of the reflections or expressions on the astrophysical scale of the principle of reason. Something which is always there in the universe. We look at the astrophysics of the human mind, the ideas and astrophysics of the human mind. These objects are not really just way out there, many light years away, but in a certain sense, they're demonstrating principles which are operating everywhere and at every time in the whole universe. So, of course, this inevitably leads to the necessity of continuing the process that Nicholas of Cusa laid out. We have to now take these phased array instruments. We just started. We're still trapped near the Earth. To move out into Mars, to go out away from this noisy sun, away from the noisy Earth, to just deploy arrays of astronomical instruments. New generations of astronomical instruments based on new principles that we discover as we go. That requires also that man must go out. You get to the Moon-Mars project as just the very first step in this process. So, that gives you a kind of an idea of a trajectory for the future. And I think that's very crucial right now. Mankind needs this kind of conception which Wynne is giving to us. And it's very crucial to the youth movement, because if to the extent that the young people today really get serious, like Lynn was talking about yesterday, really get serious. I don't mean making a big face, a terrible serious face, but really get serious about the life. And take on the whole challenge, this vast challenge facing mankind today. And I'm sure in this series of victories that we have before us that we'll have many Keplers and many Beethovens arising to develop mankind, give mankind a brighter future. Thank you.